He's a world traveler and a time travel aficionado. He's known internationally for his iconic bottle cap glasses and for his red and white outfits. You can find him in pictures from Paris to Tokyo, visiting the pyramids or visiting the beach. But you won't find him unless you're looking for him. The French call him Charlie. The Germans call him Walter. But you probably know him by his English name, Waldo. Most of you have probably seen a Where's Waldo book before. I grew up with them. They are puzzle books that depict scenes from various places and various periods. And the scenes are densely populated and they're very busy. There's a lot going on. And the challenge is to look at this chaotic mess and answer the question, where's Waldo? You got to find the main character, and the main character is going to be hiding in the details. And the book of Esther is a lot like that. That's where we'll be today if you want to go ahead and start turning there. The book of Esther. There's a lot going on in the book in Esther, but God is never mentioned. Not even once. Which leads us to ask, where is God? It's a question that's caused many to doubt whether this book should even be included in the Bible. They want to know, where is God in all of this? It's a question that's never far from anyone. It lingers in the deepest, darkest places in the back of our minds, ready to spring to the tip of our tongues whenever our fears threaten to become a reality. And we ask, where is God when a child is suddenly and severely injured? Where is God when a natural disaster takes our house or a drunk driver takes our spouse? Where is God? Where is God when a loved one walks away from the faith? God is difficult to find sometimes in a fallen world. But you won't find Him unless you're looking for Him. And today, we're going to be looking for Him in this chaotic and twisting, turning book of Esther. Our text is going to take place between chapter 6 and chapter 7 of the book of Ezra. We finished chapter 6 last week. And when we look in this book, we're going to ask, where is God in all of this? Our story starts at a state-sanctioned party for the king's cabinet. Ahasuerus, he's the king of Persia. You may know him as Xerxes. He's throwing a week-long party for all the state officials. And the king, we find, has had one drink too many. And he ends up in a domestic dispute. He wants his wife, he wants Queen Vashti to come in so that he can parade around her beauty to the kingdom. And the queen says, no. And that causes a problem. So the king, the judge of the land, pulls aside the state prosecutor and he says, I need a verdict. Why don't you render for me a sentence? What should I do with my queen? And that's where we'll pick up in our story today. Chapter 1, verse 16. This is the state prosecutor's response. In the presence of the king and the princes, this prosecutor, Memucan, says, Queen Vashti has wronged not only the king, but also the princes and all the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, causing them to look with contempt on their husbands by saying, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's conduct will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of contempt and anger. If it pleases the king, let a royal edict be issued by him, and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is more worthy than she. And when the king's edict, which he will make, is heard throughout all his kingdom, great as it is, then all the women will give honor to their husbands, great and small. Well, this guy's worried that the queen's actions is going to start a women's lib movement. He says, we got to nip this thing in the bud or 10 years from now, the ladies are going to be running things. So what you need to do is make a law. Put your name on it, and you need to remove the queen from her kingdom. Now, you might recall the law, when we're talking about the law of the Medes and the Persians, that's kind of different to how previous kingdoms have run things. We talked about this in Daniel chapter 6 with Daniel in the lion's den. You might remember that the king got tricked into signing a law to put Daniel in there, and he couldn't get out of it. Why? Well, in Babylon, when Nebuchadnezzar is running things, what Nebuchadnezzar says is the law. So if Nebuchadnezzar wakes up on one side of the bed and he feels one particular way, well, that's the law in the morning. But if he eats some lunch and starts to feel a little bit different as he's going about his day, well, then the law changes. Not so with the law of the Medes and the Persians. When they make a law, the kings are actually subject to the law. So Ahasuerus makes a law. But when he's cooled down and he's sobered up, he realizes that was a really dumb thing to do. And he starts to miss his queen. And he starts to get down in the dumps. So his servants come and they say, "We have got to cheer our king up. We need to get a new queen in place. So what we're going to do is we're going to go throughout the kingdom. We're going to find all the most beautiful virgins. We're going to bring them together. We're going to parade them before the king. And we're going to let the king pick a new wife. We're going to pick his spirits back up." And it's here that we're going to be introduced to a character in the story, a Jew, a Benjamite named Mordecai. Look at verse 5. "In the citadel in Susa, a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful in form and face. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter." So orphan Esther and cousin Mordecai, their families missed the bus on the way back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. They weren't in that load of zealous Jews ready to go back to the land, ready to go back and see the glory of the Lord restored by rebuilding the temple. They hung out. They were happy where they were. And now they died, leaving Mordecai to care for Esther. And we find, look at verse 8, "So it came about when the command of the decree of the king was heard that many young ladies were gathered to the citadel of Susa, into the custody of Haggai, and Esther was taken to the king's palace, into the custody of Haggai, who was in charge of the women. Now the young lady pleased him and found favor with him. So he quickly provided her with cosmetics and food and gave her 7 choice maids from the king's palace and transferred her and her maids to the best place in the harem. Esther didn't make known to the people, though, what her kindred was, for Mordecai had instructed her that she'd not make it known to them. Every day, Mordecai walked back and forth in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and how she fared." Look at verse 15. "Now when the turn of Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as a daughter, came to go into the king, she did not request anything except what this Haggai, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the women, had advised. And Esther found favor in the eyes of all who saw her." Look at verse 17. "The king, he loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and all his servants. And he also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty." Now, questions begin to abound at this point in the story. Didn't the law prohibit Jews from eating unclean food like the kind you might have at a big banquet in Persia? Didn't the law prohibit Jews from marrying foreigners? Didn't the law prohibit sex outside of marriage like the kind that these ladies would be expected to have with the king in order to persuade him to have affections for them? Weren't all of these violations? You say, yeah, they were. But it's evidence that from the very beginning, this is not Daniel's story. This is not Daniel in Babylon. Okay? This is not a story about faithful Jews who are going against the flow. These are the leftovers. These are the ones who stayed. I know that God is with the faithful. I expect God to intervene into the lives of Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego, who are standing up for their faith and their God. They're saying, we don't care what you say, we're not bowing down to an idol. But this is a different story. And I ask, where is God? Where is God in this? Our chapter is going to end with an assassination plot. Mordecai, through nepotism, gets involved in the government system. See? His cousin gets made queen. Now Mordecai gets to become a judge. They're beginning to work in the system. And while he's working there, he overhears a couple bodyguards who are planning to kill the king. Well, that's problems for him, right? His payday ends if that happens. And he turns over this assassination plot to Esther. She warns the king. It's found out to be true. They're killed. And that's when our story begins to take a very different turn. Look at it with me in chapter 3. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and they paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servant who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, why are you transgressing the king's command? Now it was when they had spoken daily to him that he would not listen to them. And they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now I look at this, the conflict starts in the story, and I say, what's going on? Suddenly we have resistance to the flow. Why won't Mordecai bow? Is bowing a problem? Is this like Daniel's dietary dilemma where he says, look, I can't eat this food. This goes against my belief system. Is it against the law to bow down to someone who's in authority? No. No, we see it in the story. People bow down to leadership. That's okay. It's a sign of submission. The Jews are permitted. It's not necessarily worship as a god. So why won't Mordecai bow down? Look a little bit further, verse 5. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. Now we mentioned just a faithful remnant went home. So the vast majority of the Jews are still in the kingdom, Susa and surrounding districts. Haman learns Mordecai won't bow, so he decides to wipe out all the Jews? I mean, that seems a bit extreme. I say, well, what's going on? Why? Verse 4, notice it. They told Haman to see if Mordecai's reason would stand because he told them he was a Jew. See, Mordecai won't bow because he's a Jew, so they asked Haman about it to see if his reason would stand like he stands. What does that have to do anything? Why does it matter that he's a Jew? Well, notice verse 1. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. An Agagite. An Agagite would be someone who descended from Agag. So I said, who is Agag? Does that name sound familiar? Do we remember anyone by the name of Agag? Agag was a king of the Amalekites. You may recall that when Israel was trying to leave Egypt, the Amalekites, they attack them. And because of that, a little bit farther in the story, when Saul becomes king, the Lord says, look, you need to go wipe out the Amalekites. Wipe out the men, wipe out the women, wipe out the children, wipe out the cows, the dogs, the cats. If it breathes, wipe it out. And Saul goes and he wipes out some of the Amalekites, but he brings one back with him, the king, Agag. He brings the king back and then he brings the good stuff back, the sheep. For example, you know, Samuel walks in and he says, why is this bleeding going on in my ears if you did what the Lord told you to, if you carried out what the Lord had told you to do and wiped it out? Where are all these sheep sounds coming from? Why is this king still alive? So Samuel will eventually kill Agag, but not only did Saul spare the king, apparently he spared one of his sons, who is now in a leadership position over the Jewish exiles in Persia. And he finds out, Mordecai says, no, I won't bow down to you. Why? Because I'm a Jew. Because you're an Amalekite. There's no harmony between the two of us. You guys opposed us on our way out of Egypt. We have unfinished business together. And Haman says, yes, you're right. We've got unfinished business together. But I'm going to finish it. We'll solve that right here. He goes to the king, verse 8. He says that he casts some lots. He tries to find out what's the best day according to these pagan demon astrologers to wipe out the Jews. He finds a day. He goes to the king, verse 8. He says to Ahasuerus, look, there's a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. Look, I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business to put it in the king's treasuries. And the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, the silver is yours and the people also. Do with them as you please. He says, okay, Haman, here's my pen, the red one, the one that makes laws. Go take the pen and make it official. Do whatever you want with this people. I could care less. And so he does. He makes a law. Notice it, verse 13. Letters are sent by courier to all the provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day. The 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to seize their possessions and plunder. Well, that's pretty close to God's original command to Saul. It's a little different. You know, he says, go wipe out the people, but keep their stuff. In fact, that's a little incentive, because Haman wants to make sure it gets done. So if he goes and says, look, it's open season on the Jewish people. This wealthy people in the land that have all kinds of stuff, whatever they got, go take it. On this one day of the year, there'll be no ramifications. You got a beef with somebody? Kill them. They can't fight back. You'll have the military at your disposal if you need it. You need some land? Go and take it. The property's yours. You need some cattle? Take it. Sheep, it's yours. One day. And I ask, where is God? Did God go with the people back to the land with the instruments of the temple, the faithful remnant? Did he go and just leave the rest of the people to rot? Where is God? You're a Jew. You're minding your own business somewhere in Persia. And then suddenly a courier comes in and he says, at the end of the year, your stuff gets taken away, your family gets killed, you're done. No fault of your own, you're minding your own business. I don't think it would be much better if you did know that, hey, there's this one guy over here in the capital, or at least in the winter capital of Persia, where the king's winter home is, who has a beef with somebody, and because of that, we're going to kill you and your family. I don't think that'd make it much better. It's unjust. It's terrible. And where is God? Well, the people mourn. Mordecai dons sackcloth and ashes. Notice it. Verse 3, chapter 4. In each province, everywhere where the command and the decree came, great mourning among the Jews, with fasting, with weeping, with wailing, with sackcloth, with ashes. And bad news travels fast. Mordecai joins him, and Esther finds out. She says, what's the deal? She sends her couriers to Mordecai. Why are you mourning? What's going on? He says, don't you know? Don't you know that your husband has decreed to have us all wiped out? Really, it's Haman is conspiring. Haman's hatched this plot. He's paid all this silver. He says he'll foot the bill. Your people are going to be destroyed. And he sends her a copy of the law and he says, do something. Save your people. Do something. Notice her response. Chapter 4, verse 11. She says, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king calls out to him a golden scepter so that he may live. And I haven't been summoned by the king for 30 days. Esther says, cousin, that is terrible news. But if you recall, the previous queen got dismissed for not coming at the king's command. There's a law that if I do go without his command, I could be killed. She says, I'm sorry. That's too bad. It really is too bad. But it's out of my hands. You know, I got to take care of me over here. Number one to think about. Notice his response. Verse 13. Mordecai sends a reply to Esther. He says, do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this. Mordecai says, if you're looking for Persia to deliver you, if you're looking for security in any place other than the God of the Jews, you're looking in the wrong place. Don't think it can't happen to you. He's saying, don't think that you are the exception. Don't think that you are special. Don't think that somehow the rules don't apply to you, Esther. Says, God is a faithful God. He is a covenant-keeping God. He's a God who has made promises to the Jewish people. He's a God who is currently fulfilling those promises with those who have been brought back to the land. And he says, look, if deliverance doesn't come from within, it's going to come from without. And if the Lord has to come to Susa and burn this palace down to provide deliverance, well, he's not going to hesitate with you in it. So you can either get on God's team or you can get on the other team. And that's her choices. Or at last he says, now, who knows whether or not you have attained royalty for such a time as this? An interesting statement. He says, maybe God hasn't been so distant after all, Esther. Maybe he didn't take off with the rest of the remnant and leave us in the land. Maybe God's in this thing, he's been in this thing from the very beginning. Maybe he's the one who's putting you in these positions. Maybe he's the one who removed Vashti. Maybe he's the one who gave you favor with that eunuch for such a time as this. Verse 15. Then Esther replies, go assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will also fast in the same way. And thus I'll go on into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish. And so Mordecai went away and did just as Esther commanded them. She doesn't seem confident about this thing, but she complies. She fasts. She asked the people to fast. Just a brief note about fasting. When we think of fasting, oftentimes what are we thinking of? You know, I'm abstaining from food or drink or both. Why? I think a lot of times the idea is I'm abstaining for a result. I abstain. I really want God to hear my prayer, so I better fast. I really want forgiveness from the Lord, so I better fast. I really want this result, and the means to get that result is if I do this thing. That's not fasting. Fasting is not about getting results. Fasting is about a response. It is the natural, inevitable response to a grievous moment. Everybody in this room has probably fasted at some point in their life. When you had some terrible event happen, and you felt you were so concerned about what this event was that happened, you lost your appetite. It is the inevitable, natural response to a grievous event. That's what fasting is. So there's this terrible event looming for the Jews and for Esther as she tries to go and intercede for the Jews. She says, fast with me. It's a mourning. Mourn with me. Responding to a grievous event. Sometimes there's a result that happens, like God intervenes in some way, or a miraculous answer to prayer happens, or something like that. But it's not because you're doing the fast to achieve it. No, this is a response to a grievous moment. So she's saying, fast with me because of this terrible thing that's taken place, and I'm going to go on behalf of y'all to try to fix it. So she approaches the king. Chapter 5. Notice his response. He extends the golden scepter. He's happy to see her. And he says, what's troubling you? Verse 3, Queen Esther, what is your request? Even to half the kingdom, it shall be given to you. He's not going to make the same mistake he made with Vashti. Esther says, if it pleases the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet that I've prepared for them. He says, saddle up, Haman. Let's go. They go to the banquet, and Haman is having a great day. Not only is he acknowledged before the king, he's acknowledged before the queen. It doesn't get any better than this. He's been invited as the sole guest to an exclusive party for royalty. He is making it. He is going somewhere. He is a somebody. He has security in the Persian kingdom. They get to the party, and they're enjoying each other and they're enjoying themselves, at which point Ahasuerus asks, he says, look, I gotta ask, Esther. So we're here at the party. Tell me, what is it that you want? Even up to half the kingdom, just let me know. She says, you know what I'd really like is if you guys would come back again tomorrow. Let me throw you another party. And then I'll tell you what I really want there. King says, okay, you got it. And Haman, of course, things just got better. Couldn't get better. Guess what they did? Not only did you get invited to an exclusive party once, but twice. Okay, he is having a very good, great day. And he cannot wait to get home to tell his family and to tell his friends how respected he is. How he's moving on up in Persia. But on his way, he runs into somebody else. Notice it. Verse 9. Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. And when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he didn't stand up or tremble before him, Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. His very good, great day turns into a no good, very bad day. I got all these good things going on, but I can't enjoy them because there's still this guy who doesn't respect me, this guy who hates my people, that I can't do anything about yet. I can't enjoy myself as long as this guy's around. So when he gets home, rather than just bragging about all the wonderful things and celebrating with his family, he says, look, I got all these great things, but there's this guy. And I don't know what to do about him. They said, we know what you can do about him. Notice it. His wife has a suggestion. His wife and friends, verse 14, say to Haman, why don't you have a gallows? This could be a hangman's gallows. It could be a pike in the ground. 50 cubits high made. And on the morning, ask the king to have Mordecai hanged on it. And then go joyfully with the king to that banquet. And the advice pleased Haman. So he said, let's do it. Have the gallows made. Meanwhile, chapter 6. During that night, the king couldn't sleep. So he gave an order to bring the book of the records of the Chronicles. And they were read before the king. He says, I can't sleep. Go find the most boring book in the kingdom. Okay, well, here's this one of all the tasks that we take care of. Here's the record books of the kingdom. Read that. That'll put you down. He says, okay. Notice it. Verse 2. It was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning these two fellows, these two of the king's eunuchs, who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, what honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? And the king's servants who attended him said, nothing. Nothing has been done. He saves the king's life, and what does he get for it? Nothing. Makes it look like the king's life is worth nothing. He does nothing. And now at this time, the king's thinking about it, and it just so happens, you know who shows up on the doorstep. Here's Haman, because Haman has a request. What does he want? Mordecai hanged on the gallows in the morning. So he's going to come and he's going to ask the king, but before he can get the words out of his mouth, the king shoots a question at him. Verse 6. Haman came in through the door. The king says to him, what is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor? And Haman's thinking, Well, who does the king want to honor more than me? I mean, I've been invited to two exclusive banquets with just the king and the queen. I'm like his bestie. Of course he's talking about me. So he thinks about it. He says, what would I really want to happen? What would I want the king to do for me? Well, you should dress this fellow up in the king's outfit. You should put him on the king's horse. And you should have someone who's a prince or respected in the kingdom have to drag him around the kingdom and parade him around and say, this is what the king will do for the person in whom he is pleased. And Ahasuerus says, that is a great idea. You go do it for Mordecai right away. Haman is having a horrible, no good, very bad day. He parades Mordecai around, and then he rushes home embarrassed. He tells his wife everything. He says, you're not going to believe this. I showed up to try to have him put on the gallows, but before I could ask, the king actually asked me to go and to parade him around and magnify him in the kingdom. And his wife says, all right, you got to tell me, this Mordecai isn't Jewish, is he? If he's a Jew, you got big trouble. But before they can finish their conversation, he's called back to the banquet. You're needed at Esther's banquet. And he's rushed off. And the king and Haman arrive at the party, and they're having drinks, and he's trying to forget about this horrible experience he's had. And the king turns to Esther and says, okay, I'm here. It's the second day, your second banquet. Please tell me, what is it that you would like me to do for you? Anything up to half the kingdom. The queen answers, verse 3. If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition, and my people as my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Now, if I had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not be commensurate with the annoyance to the king. The king is dumbstruck. Who could possibly be so stupid to threaten the queen's life? It would be insane. It would be treasonous. It would be suicidal. Verse 5. The king says, "Who is he and where is he who would presume to do this?" And Esther said, "A foe and an enemy is the wicked Haman." Then Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. Haman is having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. So the king storms out. He's furious. Unlike the king, he's very impulsive. He tries to go count the 10 outside. And Haman takes the chance. He falls at the queen's feet. He's begging her. He's pleading her, "Spare my life. Spare my life." But then when the king walks back in the room, verse 8, he sees Haman falling on the couch where Esther was. And the king says, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out from the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And then Harbonah, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, "Behold, indeed the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, that's 75 feet, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king." The king said, "Hang him on it." And so they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai. And the king's anger subsided. Thus comes to an end Haman's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. But that doesn't solve our problem, does it? Remember, the law of the Medes and the Persians is irrevocable. So this persecutor of the Jews is out of the way, but the Jews are still on the chopping block, and there's no way out of it. So what happens? Well, the king can't stop it, but what he can do is give them a fighting chance. So Esther appeals to the king. He writes a counter law. He gives them the ability to write a law. They can fight back. And when the day comes, they fight. 75,000 people are wiped out. They wipe them out, but they leave their stuff. Because it's not about getting stuff. It's about slaying the enemies of the Lord. The ones that they left with Saul. John MacArthur says it this way. He says it was a day to remember, but not for the reason that Haman had thought. The great day, March 7th, 473 BC, established a festival that the Jews celebrate today. They celebrate it at that time of year. Every year it's called the Feast of Purim, from the Hebrew word for lots, because Haman cast lots to determine the day on which he would exterminate the Jews. So I look at this story, this interesting little story that finds its way into the Old Testament, this story that people debate if it even should be in the Bible, and I ask, where is God in Esther? What's the point? Why do we have this? Where isn't God in Esther? He's there in the chauvinist advisor. He's there in that enthusiastic unit. He's there in lavish banquets. He's there in a sleepless night. He's the God in whom we live and move and have our being. But you will not find him if you are not looking for him. He's the God that is at work in the world. He's the God that gets his hands dirty and reaches down from transcendence into immanence. He comes into our lives and works through our lives. Most of the plot, you probably noticed in this story, is driven along by actors that just kind of walk in, say one thing, and then turn and exit stage left. The major characters aren't driving this story along. The king, Ahasuerus, I don't know if he makes a single decision on his own in the entire book. What should I do with Queen Vashti? What would you like me to do for the man whom I want to magnify, Haman? Esther, what do you want me to do for you at your feast? They're all under the influence of someone, of something. God is doing major things in this story through minor characters. He still does major things through minor characters today. Minor characters like you and me. To which I say, who knows? Maybe he's put you in this place for such a time as this.